Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over 30,000 books have been written and several documentaries have been made about the Vietnam War. We have long been told that events such as the notorious My Lai Massacre, in which 500 Vietnamese civilians were slaughtered, were isolated events. They were carried out by a few, quote, bad apples. But today's guest, journalist Nick Terse, argues the indiscriminate killing of non-combatants was neither accidental nor unforeseeable. He writes, quote, even as that one event has become the subject of a number of books, all the other atrocities perpetrated by U.S. soldiers have essentially vanished from popular memory. Violence against the Vietnamese was not exceptional. It was pervasive and systematic, the predictable consequence of orders to, quote, kill anything that moves, end quote. War crimes from Vietnam to Afghanistan have been exposed and confirmed over the years. So why do these atrocities continue? And what is our role in preventing massacres and war crimes from happening again and again? Nick Terse is an author, journalist, and managing editor of Tom Dispatch. His new book is Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. It's based on a decade of research and secret Pentagon files and extensive interviews with American veterans and Vietnamese survivors. Nick's previous books are The Case for Withdrawal from Afghanistan and The Complex. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back, I should say. So let's start off and talk about when the first clues to what you call this hidden history really revealed itself. It was almost by accident back in June 2001. You were a graduate student researching post-traumatic stress disorder among Vietnam veterans. And one afternoon, you were looking through documents at the U.S. National Archives when an archivist asked you, quote, could witnessing war crimes cause post-traumatic stress? Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was, as you said, I was a graduate student, and I was down at the National Archives trying to find hard data, records to match up against self-reports that we had from American veterans about where they had served, when it was. And I'd been down for 2 weeks, and every research avenue that I'd tried, I'd struck out with. I just hit dead end after dead end, and I finally went to that archivist, and I asked him, you know, you have to supply me with at least a lead, some reason to come back here. I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. And that's what he said to me. He said, do you think that, you know, witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I said, that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes? And he told me about a group of files that had been sitting down in the archives basement for around 7 years. It's called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group. And I told him that I'd like to take a look. And within an hour, I was paging through box after box of records. And to call it a treasure trove of information is the wrong phrase. This was a horror trove. We're talking about hundreds of reports made by American GIs and recently returned veterans about massacres, murder, rape, torture, mutilation. It was a horrific record, and I realized very quickly that this wasn't in the literature anywhere, that no one had worked with these records. And this really set me out on the journey that ended with Kill Anything That Moves.
You know, as a journalist, I wondered, why have these files been kept secret for so long, considering the fact that over 30,000 books have been written about Vietnam? I mean, even that number was shocking to me. I thought, did I read that wrong? Was it 3,000? But 30,000 books and these documents were sitting there gaining dust? What explains that?
Well, I mean, at the time, these documents were kept secret. This was a secret Pentagon task force. It was unofficial, and it operated out of the Army Chief of Staff's office. And it was put together in the wake of the notorious My Lai Massacre, where 500 Vietnamese civilians were killed on March 16, 1968. The Army resolved never to be caught flat-footed by an atrocity scandal again. So the idea was that this group of colonels, headed by one brigadier general, would keep tabs on all allegations that they saw popping up, and whenever they could, they would tamp them down and, attempt, and very often they were successful in making them disappear.
And so thanks to one of your professors who funded this project, you spent many days copying all of these documents.
That's right. I came back, you know, with these archives. You know, they were just stuck in my head. They weren't useful for the project on PTSD that I was working on because they weren't systematic. They're not useful for an epidemiologist because war crimes are generally covered up. You don't have a full record, anything like that. But these records really, they put the hook in me, and I was working on a different dissertation at the time. So I tried to get a couple of Vietnam War historians that I knew to go down there and work with the records, but everyone was working on another project, or they were burnt out on the war, something like that. And one of them told me that he thought that I should get down there and I should write a book on this, but do it immediately. And I went to my advisor and I said that this is the advice that I got. Did he think that I could write a book and my dissertation at the same time? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, it's not possible. But if these records are that important, then you should switch your dissertation and you should get down there and make copies of the records. And I thought he was being a little bit paranoid. I didn't think that it was necessary to run right back to the archives. And frankly, I didn't have the money to do it. And I said, I'll have to put together a grant proposal, something like that. And he wrote me out a check right then and there and said, get down there and get them. So I within 24 hours, I was down in the archives, and I put every cent that he gave me into copying. And I'd copy from the time they opened in the morning until they threw me out at night. And then I went in my car, and I slept in the archives parking lot in my car. And the next morning, as soon as they opened, I went in and copied. And, eventually I put together the whole collection, and I brought it back and wrote my dissertation from it. And it turned out that my advisor's fears were well-founded, because after the first time I published on these documents, sometime after that, they were pulled from the archive shelves, and they haven't been publicly available since then.
Have you asked government officials about these documents to find out where they are and why they've been pulled?
Yeah, there were legitimate reasons to pull them in the first place. There were some Privacy Act concerns. They contained some identifying information that is normally restricted. And it made sense to redact the documents. But, they were pulled from the shelves about 12 years ago. And there seems to me to have been enough time to redact them in the years since. But they haven't gotten around to that. So
your book is based on these documents. And again, the War Crimes Working Group files includes more than 300 allegations of massacres, murders, rapes, torture, assaults, mutilations, and other atrocities. This is really important to point out. They were substantiated by Army investigators. Can you talk about why it's really important to point that out?
Right. Sometimes people have cast these strictly as allegations that these were just wild stories made up by disgruntled GIs, things like that. But there are hundreds of cases that the military investigated, and sometimes extremely thorough investigations. We're talking about phone book size thickness investigation files, where they corroborated all the claims that were made by an original whistleblower, and then added to it with testimony from other veterans in the unit. So there are hundreds like this. And then on top of that, there are hundreds more that are considered unfounded. That is, that they did not determine that the charges could be leveled. But in these cases, you find that many of them were closed in a summary fashion. It looks like very little to no work was done investigating. And just to give people an idea, one of these unfounded cases involved a group from the 101st Airborne known as the Tiger Force. And some people may remember back in 2003, the Toledo Blade exposed a rash of atrocities, a string of killings by this Tiger Force. Well over 100 Vietnamese, maybe over 1,000 really killed by this unit. But if you look in the War Crimes Working Group files, you'll find it listed as unfounded, that is, uncorroborated.
So these are substantiated. Your book is also based on extensive interviews with Vietnamese survivors and American veterans. You write that some of the veterans you tried to contact wanted nothing to do with you, almost instantaneously slamming down the phone receiver. But most were willing to speak with you. Many even seemed glad to talk to someone who had a sense of the true nature of the war. You write, quote, in homes from Maryland to California, across kitchen tables and in marathon four-hour telephone calls. Scores of former soldiers and Marines opened up about their experiences. Some had little remorse. An interrogator who tortured prisoners, for instance, told me that his actions were merely standard operating procedure. Another veteran, whispering so that his family would not overhear, adamantly insisted that though he'd been present at a massacre of civilians, he hadn't pulled the trigger no matter what his fellow members said. So, Nick, your main argument is that in these 30,000 books and so many documentaries that have been made about Vietnam, we are basically told that the notorious My Lai massacre, in which 500 Vietnamese civilians were slaughtered, was really an isolated event. This was carried out by a few bad apples. I mean, we even hear that term today, a few bad apples. And later in the show, we'll talk about how all of this relates to what we're dealing with today. And your argument is that this was not accidental nor unforeseeable. We cannot talk about all of the war crimes and atrocities that you uncovered, which you detail greatly in your book. What would you say really struck you the most about what you uncovered?
Well, when I first had these records in hand, you know, I knew that they weren't in the literature anywhere, and you know, I started to get a sense of the American side of the story, but I wanted to learn, you know, the Vietnamese viewpoint. So I went to Vietnam with these records in hand, and I was looking for, you know, witnesses and survivors to this one spasm of violence, say one massacre. And when I would go into a rural Vietnamese hamlet and be looking for information about this one case, what I found the Vietnamese people telling me about again and again was not this, you know, one particular thing that I came to talk about, but what it was like to live for 10 years under bombs and shells and helicopter gunships, and how they had to negotiate their lives around the American war. All the calculations that they made on a daily basis. Generally, their homes had been burned down once, twice, three, five, six times, and they would then stop rebuilding them and simply live in their bomb shelters. So they were living a subterranean existence. And they would have to figure out when to leave the bomb shelter to farm. This was an everyday problem, because it generally wasn't safe to be out during the day because you could be spotted by a helicopter and gunned down. But so they would try and go farm at night. But anyone seen out at night was assumed to be a guerrilla. So if you were spotted, there probably wasn't even a chance that they wouldn't fire on you. You had to figure out when to go out and forage for food, when to try and get some water, when you could actually go out and relieve yourself. And, you know, your life came down to this everyday calculus to try and figure out what it would take to survive, to keep yourself and your family alive. And this is the story that really made an impression on me, and one that I knew wasn't in the literature and that I felt was desperately necessary to tell. You know, I talk in the book about the immensity of Vietnamese civilian suffering. We're talking about millions of Vietnamese killed or wounded or made refugees, and this is due to deliberate U.S. policies, like the use of almost unrestrained bombing and artillery shelling across wide swaths of the countryside. So it's deliberate policies dictated at the highest levels of the U.S. military. Now, the original records with these micro-level crimes, like massacres and murders, they help to inform me about, you know, and they punctuate the book. But what I really hope to get across is just, you know, what life was like for the Vietnamese civilian, you know, for the everyday of the war.
You write that one veteran told you that his training made it clear that the, quote, enemy is anything with slant eyes who lives in the village. It doesn't make any difference if it's a woman or child, end quote. An officer summarized the prevailing mindset, quote, so a few women and children get killed, teach them a damn good lesson. They're all Viet Cong, or at least helping them. You can't convert them, only kill them, end quote. Talk to us about just some of the experiences you had meeting the Vietnamese civilians, and when did you go there, and what stories did they want you to bring back to the U.S.?
Well, I traveled to Vietnam four times, you know, beginning in 2006, and some of these trips were for weeks at a time and some months, and you know, I was always shocked by the lack of animosity. A lot of times I was the first American to show up in the village since the war. You know, in many cases, I probably was the first unarmed Westerner to ever walk through the village all they'd ever known were French troops or American troops. And I guess it was so far removed from the American experience. I assume that there would at least be some residual anger, but I would go in. I'd talk to these people about the most traumatic incidents imaginable, about the worst days of their lives. But I'd find afterwards that they would be thanking me. They were shocked that any American knew about their village or knew something of their story, what it was like for them during the war. They were amazed that someone would travel halfway around the world to actually listen to what they had to say. This isn't, it's not part of our narrative of the war in the U.S., but it's also not part of the Vietnamese narrative of the war. Civilians have really been left out of the story there, too. So generally, it's not even something that young people in Vietnam know about. So a lot of times when parents were telling me the story, their children were sitting there wrapped. They'd never heard these stories before. They knew the war was bad and traumatic, but they didn't know exactly what their elders had been through.
Describe what these villages look like today and how they've been affected by this war.
Well, where I was generally, way out in the in rural areas. During the war, they would have looked similar. Large expanses of rice paddies, punctuated by homes along a central roadway. Generally, at the time, homes were thatch roof and wattle walls or bamboo. Today, they're mostly concrete homes. But where I was, the life cycle really revolves around the rice growing seasons and still with livestock raising and fruit trees, that type of thing. It's a agrarian lifestyle. And Vietnamese are very rooted to their land. So even those who were driven out of the villages eventually into refugee camps and slums, they returned to their home villages, and they were still there, when I came decades later.
We're speaking with journalist Nick Terse about his new book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. This book is based on more than a decade of research in secret Pentagon files and extensive interviews with American veterans and Vietnamese survivors. And Nick Terse argues that the My Lai massacre was not an isolated event. This was pervasive and systematic, the predictable consequence of orders to, quote, kill anything that moves. And we'd love to hear from you. If you've got any questions about what Nick uncovered looking at all of these documents about the Vietnam War, and why do you think it's important to still focus on this issue? What we're going to also talk about after the break is, when you talk about war crimes and atrocities, Nick has uncovered what is happening in Vietnam. We had Winter Soldier, where a number of soldiers talked about war crimes committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what will it take to ensure that these atrocities stop? And why do they continue? What role can we play in playing a part to try to end this violence? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Also, if you served in Vietnam, if you remember what that time was, and if you have questions about what happened, we'd love to hear from you. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hey, morning. I, as somebody who listened to virtually every word of the Winter Soldier Tribunal, I'm glad your guest is bringing this up. To listen to each of the panelists introduce themselves, many of them made it plain that they were not some kind of liberals who had gotten drafted in Vietnam. Many of the participants in the Winter Soldier Tribunal of the early 70s made it plain that their families were longtime soldiers, multi-generational soldiers who, once they realized that torture and abuse of civilians and the Geneva Convention was a policy, they made it plain that they were joining in that tribunal to regain America's reputation. So, I appreciate your guest bringing this up at this late date. But one thing, well, there were two different rumors that I had heard. One was that there was a massive amount of oil off the shore of Vietnam, an oil field that stretched basically from Australia up to the Vietnam coast, and whether or not he had done any study of the oil playing a role in the attack on Vietnam. And the second was whether or not heroin was smuggled out of U.S. servicemen into the United States. It was said that that the Golden Triangle, of course, was a massive heroin production area, and that basically U.S. carcasses, U.S. corpses, were being used as travel containers to ship heroin into the United States. So it was landing in U.S. bases and being transferred off of those bases onto the streets.
All right. Well, thank you for the questions, David. Nick, we have to go to break soon, but do you want to quickly take the heroin question?
Well, that's been a story that's out there for years. There was certainly heroin trade coming from Southeast Asia at the time, and the CIA was implicated in involvement in that. It's really outside the purview of my research, but there are some historians like Al McCoy who have looked into that and have written on it in greater detail.
All right, and David, we'll get to the rest of your question right after a break. Today we are speaking with Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Nick is an author, a journalist, managing editor of TomDispatch.com. And if you have any questions for Nick about what he uncovered when he looked at this massive trove of documents and spent a decade interviewing veterans and Vietnamese survivors, we would love to hear from you. What questions do you still have about Vietnam? And how does this apply to what we're facing today? It's your call. We'll be back after this. You know what? I actually got my time wrong. We have 10 more minutes. You know what? My clock is off in here. That's why. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. My clock is off in my room, so I thought we were going to break right now. We actually have just a couple more minutes. So, Nick, why don't you address David's question about oil?
Well, I think there are a lot of geopolitical reasons why Vietnam was strategically important. I don't think oil was, one of the top reasons at the time, although now off the coast, Vietnam and China are wrangling over some islands in that area where there's great energy reserves underneath. And so, these days it's more of a point of contention than it was during the war. But, the caller brings up a very interesting point about Winter Soldier.
Yes, and just to remind listeners, Winter Soldier happened in March of 2008. A number of veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan talked about war crimes, everything from taxi drivers fired upon at will, people shot for opening doors, people shot for speaking on cell phones, risking death if they wore the wrong thing, if they carried shovels, for example. And this didn't get much attention, but we did actually do several stories about shows about this, just to let listeners know.
Yes, and I think that the caller was actually talking about the original Winter Soldier, that the one you're talking about was patterned on, which took place in 1971. This was returning Vietnam veterans. More than 100 of them gathered together in Detroit, Michigan, and they spoke out about the same things that the Iraq War vets spoke out about at the more recent Winter Soldier.
Right. Nick, we actually now have to take a break. We're speaking with Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, and we'll be back after this.
San Francisco is a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255, or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to this morning's program. And that's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. It's all on yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Agenda for a New Economy series. We'll be speaking with Anat Shenkar Osorio about her new book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. She argues that the financial crisis was progressives' big chance to drastically change the conversation about the economy. But it didn't happen. Why? Where should the conversation about the economic crisis go from here? And how can progressives influence this very important conversation? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by journalist Nick Terse. He is out with a new book called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. It's based on over a decade of research in secret Pentagon files and extensive interviews with American veterans and Vietnamese survivors. He argues that the notorious My Lai massacre was not an isolated incident carried out by only a, quote, few bad apples. This was pervasive and systematic, the predictable consequence of orders to, quote, kill anything that moves. And if you have a question for Nick about what he uncovered about what really happened during Vietnam, we'd love to hear from you. If you served in Vietnam, what are your thoughts about what Nick uncovered? And then we'd also like to move on and talk about what we're facing today, because the Winter Soldiers, who testified a couple of years ago, talked about ongoing war crimes. There was testimony in a basement on Capitol Hill where only a handful of politicians showed up, but nothing was ever done. So what will it take to end these atrocities? What role do we play in preventing war crimes from happening again and again? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So Nick, going back to Winter Soldier, I'm glad you brought up Winter Soldier that took place in 1971, because I wanted to also talk about the current Winter Soldier and just really ask you, you know, why does this continue and what will it take to end it? But why don't you go back to Winter Soldier? What was the end result of that 1971 event?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the veterans who were there were smeared by the Nixon administration and like-minded individuals as fake veterans. They said that they didn't serve in Vietnam. They were impersonating veterans. But you know, those who have looked into this, and this was one of the big Detroit metro papers looked into the backgrounds of the Winter Soldiers and the FBI and military intelligence and even Army Criminal Investigation Command. They all looked at the records and found that these were, in fact, true returning Vietnam veterans. They had served in Vietnam. They had their discharge papers with them. And, you know, unfortunately, in the literature, a lot of times it's painted as, you know, it's unclear whether or not they were real Vietnam vets or not. But, you know, the files that I examined showed that, by and large, the military is able to prove that all of these men served in Vietnam. And they painted a really startling picture. They talked about atrocities like murder, rape, assault, mutilation, and they said that the atrocities in Vietnam stemmed from higher command. This was higher headquarters that had issued orders that made atrocities almost inevitable. And in fact, one of the veterans that I focus on in the book, named Jamie Henry, he really came to affect my life, and I tell his story in Kill Anything That Moves. He was a Winter Soldier, but before that, you know, before the war, he was a self-described hippie living in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district. But he was drafted, and he became a medic, and a very good one. He saved a lot of American lives, and the men who served with him said he was an excellent soldier. But he was also shocked by what he saw in Vietnam. On his first day in the field, he watched the point man, the lead man in his patrol, molest a young girl, and he thought to himself, you know, my God, what's going on here? And over the ensuing months, he watched a litany of atrocities take place in his unit. He saw a young boy who was executed for no reason, an old man who was used for target practice, a prisoner thrown off a cliff, a man who was held down to be run over by an armored personnel carrier, basically a small tank. But when he spoke up about this brutality, his life was threatened. And even his friends said to him, look, you need to keep your mouth shut, or you're going to get shot in the back during a firefight, and no one's going to be the wiser. So Jamie kept his mouth shut, but he kept his eyes open. He kept cataloging these things. And it culminated in on February 8, 1968, his unit moved into a small hamlet on patrol, and their commanding officer, a West Point trained captain, ordered that all the civilians there be rounded up. And then he gave an order to kill anything that moves. And Jamie heard this over the radio. He was sitting down to take a break, smoking a cigarette. And he heard this, and he got up, and he tried to make his way towards the captain. He wanted to intervene. But he showed up just seconds late. He watched as the five men around these civilians opened up on full automatic with their M16s and killed all of them. And Jamie told me that 30 seconds after that massacre, he vowed to blow the whistle on it. So he came home and he reported it to an Army lawyer who told him to keep quiet because there were a million ways that the Army could make him disappear. He went and found an Army criminal investigator, but that man threatened him. He wrote to several congressmen, but no one got back to him. Then he spoke out. He went to public forums, including Winter Soldier. He published an article. He held a press conference. But he could never get any traction and eventually gave up. And it was only after I called him and then I showed up on his doorstep with several phone book-sized stacks of records. Only then did he know that the Army actually conducted a thorough investigation that corroborated everything he'd said. But, of course, it had been kept secret from him and from the American public. After Winter Soldier, the military knew this had happened, but they'd never revealed that they knew. And what would have been the first story about a My Lai-style massacre with full corroboration wasn't exposed for 40 years.
We're speaking with Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, speaking to us about a story involving Jamie Henry, a former Army medic, one of the many veterans that Nick Terse interviewed for this book. We've got full lines, so let's go next to Kit in Oakland. Hi, Kit. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question. I was brought up with a war patron. My dad went to World War II and bombed in Dresden, and I'm curious, what are some of the particulars of the training that Vietnamese boys got with, you know, some of the past history of World War II? How did that affect their view and how they worked in battle? And secondly, can you talk a little bit about Kissinger's plans? Did that have a play in this?
All right, thank you. Do you want to take the training question first, Nick?
Sure. You know, one aspect of the training that kept coming up with veterans that I talked to was basically they told me about the racism and dehumanization that really suffused the training that they went through. I mean, it's important to remember that the average infantryman in Vietnam was 18, 19, 20 years old. So they're basically American teenagers. They're boys that are kind of thrown into this, and they were given exceptionally lackluster training for the type of war that they were going to fight. This wasn't some sort of classic World War I, army against army battle. They were going to fight in a guerrilla war, and a lot of them would be made to fight in and around Vietnamese villages. But they weren't given any particular training on how to fight a war amongst the people. They were told to win hearts and minds. This was in pamphlets and the official literature that they're given. But what they were told by their drill instructors and then when they got to Vietnam, their sergeants, they were really told that all Vietnamese were likely the enemy, mm-hmm. that children might hold grenades and women were constructing booby traps, or they might even be fighters themselves, and that everyone was a suspect, and it was generally safer to shoot first because no one would ask questions later. The racism that I was told about was, they said veterans would tell me that they heard this from the moment they entered boot camp, that you didn't call them Vietnamese. You called them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, any of these racist terms to dehumanize the enemy and make it easier to kill them, anything to take away their humanity. And, a lot of them told me that, even they might even recognize that it was wrong. You know, there are a lot of African-American veterans that I talked to who said they knew that this was racist, and they knew they'd experienced the same things back in the U.S., but they were just steeped in it from the moment they got there, and it just became natural. This became, there was an acronym in Vietnam called the MGR, or the Mere Gook Rule, and they said that basically they were told that the Vietnamese weren't real people. They were subhumans, mere gooks who could be abused or even killed at will. And many Vietnamese suffered because of this.
You know, what's interesting, Nick, is with all the stories and conversations about the military in this country, we rarely talk about the training process. And you write that, quote, for 8 weeks of up to 17-hour days, every detail of their lives was prescribed, every action relearned in a military manner, all stringently enforced by the omnipresent authority of the drill instructor. They consisted of both psychological debasement and physical suffering, everything from being forced to eat garbage to being exercised to the point of collapse. At the same time, everyday training itself could be an agonizing experience. Even the best athletes were often overtaxed by the grueling workouts. And I think about what we're facing today. And just yesterday, there was an op-ed in the Washington Post by Marine Captain Timothy Kudo. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan. His piece is called, I Killed People in Afghanistan, Was I Right or Wrong? And he writes, quote, when I joined the Marine Corps, I knew I would kill people. I was trained to do it in a number of ways, from pulling a trigger to ordering a bomb strike to beating someone to death with a rock. And I have to say, that line really got me. Beating someone to death with a rock? I mean, this is happening. This is part of the training, and we really don't talk about this.
Yeah, that line struck me as well, and I found it to be a very poignant piece overall. There's one thing that veterans also remember a lot is they were made to chant, kill, kill, kill. This was, you know, throughout training, and they were given bayonet training. This very rough hand-to-hand type combat is what they were trained in, how to kill someone with a bayonet or even a shovel. And, a lot of them saw this as a brutalization process. They got to boot camp as little more than boys, and you're really stripped of your identity. The idea is that the military creates a tabula rasa on which it can imprint this military imprint. And it was really a culture of violence and racism for a lot of those who served. And, again, this is a root cause, I think, to the suffering that we saw in Vietnam.
And don't you think we should be talking about this? I mean, in some ways, people are afraid to bring out these issues, right? Because a lot of people are afraid to criticize the military.
Yeah, these generally are unpalatable subjects, and this isn't a narrative that people want to hear about American service personnel. It's not. It's never been popular, and it's not the official line from the government. So. In recent years, this sort of support the troops attitude has really made it, almost impossible to have, honest conversations, even when veterans themselves try to talk about this. It's just, it's not part of the conversation.
Well, we have a veteran on the line. Let's go next to Mark in San Mateo. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to quickly underscore everything your guest has said. I was in the Air Force from March of 66 until I deserted in December of 68, and my experiences overseas took me from a young Republican activist, very conservative, patriotic, long line of military officers. My father was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. By the time I got back after 18 months, I was sent to the Pentagon when I got back, and my last hope for succeeding or having any kind of a positive outcome of my service was the hope that at the Pentagon maybe I would see something a little more positive, a little more idealistic than what I had seen in the field. And my disillusionment reached its peak standing in a copy line in the Pentagon basement in April of 68. Two colonels were in front of me. One of them, the need-to-know rule was relaxed considerably because the unit I was attached to at the Pentagon, everyone had a top-secret clearance. And the colonel in front of me asked the one in front of him what he was copying, and he replied very casually, bombing coordinates for SAC for next week should be good for about 500 dead gooks. And the other officer just laughed appreciatively, and no one within earshot reacted at all. Mm-hmm. And this was very consistent with what I had heard at a B-52 base in Thailand, where the B-52 crewmen would come back to the Airmen's Club at night and report on the what was called hung ordnance, the bombs that were loaded under the wings of B-52s. They couldn't land with them still there, so if they didn't come loose over the target, they had to shake them loose somewhere on the way back. And they said they wouldn't just do it at random. For fun, they would shake them loose over Cambodian farmhouses or fishing boats. We weren't even at war with Cambodia in any sense at that point. And one of the men just laughed and said, it looks just like dropping an egg onto cement.
Mm. Mark, let me ask you, I mean, when Nick was talking about racism, I was thinking about Iraq and Afghanistan. What can we do to stop this, or at least talk about it to make sure it ends? Because these many of the similar atrocities are happening today based on veterans' testimony.
Well, all I can say about that is I think it's somewhat inherent to war. If you read the histories of war on either side, I mean, there were things like this done by U.S. troops in World War II. There was an account in a mainstream book called The Last 900 Days, or The Last 100 Days, I think it was The Last 100 Days of World War II, that talked about U.S. troops in Bavaria going into a village and just pulling people out of their houses and mowing them down. At the time, you know, there were so many atrocities on the other side, it didn't make a ripple, but I think it's inherent that to get people to kill people that they don't know halfway around the world or even in an adjacent country, you first have to dehumanize them. And as your guest said, we were told from day one of training at Lackland Air Force Base, these are gooks, slopes, and dinks. Don't call them Vietnamese. They're not really people.
Well, thank you for calling, Mark. We'll get a response from Nick after we take a few more calls. That's Mark calling in. He's a veteran, and we're speaking with Nick Terse, author of the new book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. It's based on more than a decade of research and secret Pentagon files and extensive interviews with American vets and Vietnamese survivors. Let's go next to Demetrius in Santa Cruz. Hi, Demetrius. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you very much for having this program today. And Nick, thank you very much for coming forward with your work. I appreciate that very much. I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. I grew up in a military household. My father was a captain in the Air Force, a test pilot. And following up on the last caller, I had an uncle who was a lieutenant colonel at the time, went on to become a full colonel, who flew those B-52 bomber missions. And I can remember sitting around listening to conversations where he would laugh about the orders that he had not to bring the plane back full and randomly selecting targets on the way home to indiscriminately drop bombs out of the air. And a lot of those were in Cambodia at the time. I want to refer you to a book that was written in 1986 called Sam Keen. It's called Faces of the Enemy, if you're not familiar with it. But Sam Keen does a very thorough analysis of how there is a concentrated effort to dehumanize enemies around the world for the interests of whatever government happens to be in control and wanting to influence public opinion of the time. And when you talk about the military dehumanization that occurs to people who are brought in to fight wars, I think we need to be very aware of the fact that we are facing this kind of dehumanization now as a country, when we no longer can pick up a newspaper without seeing atrocities going on in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or any of the places where the United States is trying to operate and offer a sphere of influence, and how necessary it is to turn other cultures and other people and other religions into an enemy that is either terrorist or communist or anything opposed to the current paradigm that's trying to control public opinion. So thank you, Nick, for your work, and thank you, Rose, for the program.
Well, thank you for calling in, Demetrius. We'll take one more caller and then get Nick's response. Let's hear from Mo in San Francisco. Hi, Mo. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning, Rose. Thanks, and thank you, Nick. I was a medical tech stationed in Andrews Air Force Base in 1967, and I heard these stories from guys who had just come off the battlefield maybe 48 hours before. So, meanwhile, I was not as horrible as it was, surprising. I heard these stories from them, and also saw the souvenirs that they, some of the GIs took of Vietnamese and put them in a jar and displayed them very proudly. I don't think you can find a clean war, and it's not just uniquely American. I mean, when you ever have when you have power exerted over, you have a dominance and submission. Some atrocities are going to take place. And I don't think there is an answer to that except to eliminate war and have some peaceful negotiations or peaceful solutions to conflict.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Mo. We've got just about 5 minutes left. We'll try to take a few more calls and emails with Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves. Nick, in exposing these atrocities, what are you hoping to accomplish with this? You've received a number of very positive book reviews so far, and this is going to get a lot of attention. What are you hoping comes of this?
Well, I do think it's important that we have this, you know, the real history of the war. I think it's important that we know what was done in Vietnam in all of our names, in the name of America. But I also think that since America is constantly involved in military conflicts abroad, in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, I think it's vital that Americans understand what war is really like, especially for the people who live with war every day. That's civilians. Wars cause immense suffering, but the stories of civilians who are affected by America's wars rarely make the front pages of newspapers or lead the nightly news. And I think if Americans are called on to send their brothers and sisters and sons and daughters to war, they ought to have a clear idea of what that means. For their family members who are going to go to fight, and also for the sons and daughters of people overseas who live with these wars on an everyday basis.
We're getting several emails just about the comparisons that can be made between Vietnam and what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. A number of people are saying, how can we speak out now about what's happening today to ensure these atrocities don't continue? Do you think that's possible?
Well, I mean, I think it's vitally important that people demand, of the press and of the government, that these stories are covered and are exposed. I think that today's wars, I don't think that the killing of civilians by U.S. forces today is near the scale of the carnage in Vietnam because of the ways that artillery and air power are used. But that said, civilians still die on a regular basis in our war zones, many due to violence set off by America's invasions and occupations, and then others directly from U.S. bombing and helicopter gunships and troops on the ground. And even though the U.N. and other NGOs have made a valiant effort to give us good numbers, now, I really don't think that we know what the civilian toll has really been like.
Well, and as you report in your book, according to the data, 35% of the Vietnamese population was either killed or wounded. This is 8 million out of just 19 million. I really wanted to ask you about the Pentagon's decision to allow women to fight on the front lines. Michael just writes in and says, it's a step forward that women are, quote, allowed in combat. What really are our values? What struck me about this decision, Panetta actually made it at a Martin Luther King remembrance at the Pentagon, which didn't get much attention. But you had, magazines like Ms. Magazine celebrated this. What are your thoughts on that decision?
Well, I mean, I do feel conflicted about that. It's a tough question to answer from the men that I've spoken to who have served in these wars, generally seeing frontline combat hasn't been good to them, and that they've had to deal with it, the rest of their lives, and it hasn't been easy on them. So, I know that a lot of women have fought a long time for this, but at best it's a double-edged sword.
And in closing, do you think that veterans in Iraq and Afghanistan are offering their testimony about what's happening now? Will we learn about what's happening now in 40 years?
Well, I'm afraid, that if history is any guide, it really could be another 40 years before someone's able to put together the real story of these wars. The Pentagon has, from the Vietnam War through today, done its best to manage the narrative, and I don't think that I think it's going to take some time before we're able to figure out exactly what these wars have meant for civilians.
And who ultimately can take action on this?
Well, I think it's incumbent upon us as American citizens to demand accountability from the military and to to call upon the press corps to do its utmost. The press has really been, I think, effectively parried in a lot of ways by the military through the embedding process and things like that. And I think it's important that, hopefully before decades pass, that we have more reporters who dig into the subject. And I hope that there are people out there who want to read their stories.
Nick Turse is author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Over 30,000 books have been written about Vietnam. Many focus on the My Lai massacre as an isolated event, but as Nick Turse argues, based on over a decade of research, the indiscriminate killing of non-combatants in Vietnam was neither accidental nor unforeseeable. Nick Turse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you, and you can find more information about Nick's work at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How should progressives influence the conversation about the future of the U.S. economy? On the next Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by speaking with Anat Shenkar Osorio about her new book, Don't Buy It, The Trouble with Talking Nonsense About the Economy. She argues that the financial crisis was progressives' big chance to change the conversation, but it didn't happen. Why? Where should the conversation about the economic crisis go from here? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.